Matthew chapter 13 this morning. Well, when I first became a Christian, or at least when I think that I became a Christian, around 12, 13 years old, and then really for, I would say, most of my teenage years, so young in the faith, immature, undiscipled, and possibly at the time even falsely assured. I don't know. Maybe the Lord will reveal this to me one day. But young in my faith for, at best, and immature and undiscipled. But at that point in my life, I used to think that I had two choices about how I was going to live my life. One is that I could try and enjoy my life the best I could, right? Have fun, enjoy life, be happy. But that meant that I couldn't get too serious about following the Lord. Or I could get really serious about following the Lord, but that meant that I probably couldn't really enjoy my life and do the things that I wanted to do that I thought would make me happy in life. I wasn't really sure whether or not those two things were compatible, or if they were, how they were compatible. I thought if I get too serious about following Jesus, what if he asked me to give up things that I thought would allow me to be happy and enjoy life? So I think I did what a lot of young, immature, undiscipled, professing Christians do. I tried to identify with the Lord just enough to consider myself a Christian, but I didn't have much of a relationship with him. I believed that the Bible was God's word, but I hardly ever read it. I would sing worship songs on Sunday, and then I would go home and listen to music that celebrated all of the things that God hated. I knew that Christians were to live by faith, but I lived so much of my teenage life by my feelings. I knew that obedience to God was the right thing to do, but there was so much in my life that didn't reflect that. And I knew that I wanted and I needed just enough of Jesus in order to save me, but I was afraid of getting too serious and following him because it might mean sacrificing things that would then allow me to not really enjoy my life the way that I thought that I wanted to and that would make me happy. I had a very misguided, warped, confused, shallow view of what it meant to be a disciple and to know Jesus and to be a part of his kingdom. I mean, that didn't seem like much of a choice. Hey, get serious about following Jesus, but sacrifice enjoying life, or enjoy life, but then sacrifice getting serious about following Jesus. And if you identify with that on any level whatsoever this morning, then these parables that we are about to read and that Jesus is about to teach are meant especially for you. Because it took me some time, it took some circumstances, it took some life lessons and some life experience, it took a bunch of challenging conversations, but really most importantly, it took the power of God's Spirit at work in my life to open my eyes to see that the choice is not between getting serious about Jesus or enjoying life, because when you really know Jesus, you'll really know life. And you'll understand what real happiness is. In fact, whatever it is that you are hanging on to or refusing to let go of in an attempt to be happy and enjoy life, but it's keeping you from really knowing and following Jesus, then that is in fact the very thing that's actually keeping you from true life and happiness. Because whenever Jesus says to us, hey, give that up, let that go, right? Whatever that may be, and follow me, it is always for the sake of getting anything and everything else out of the way so that he can then give us something infinitely better and greater in himself. Now, nobody naturally thinks that or sees that or believes that. It requires spiritual eyes of faith to see that and to get that and to understand that. But Jesus gives us his word so that through it, his Spirit can open our eyes and bring us to faith, that we would see that. And I believe that's exactly what he intends to do this morning. So Let's turn back to Matthew's gospel, back to the word of Christ, and pick up reading in Matthew chapter 13, and we're going to read verse 44 through 52. The kingdom of heaven is like treasure hidden in a field, which a man found and covered up. Then in his joy, he goes and sells all that he has and buys that field. Again, the kingdom of heaven is like a merchant in search of fine pearls, who on finding one pearl of great value went and sold all that he had and bought it. Again, the kingdom of heaven is like a net that was thrown into the sea and gathered fish of every kind. When it was full, men drew it ashore and sat down and sorted the good into containers, but threw away the bad. So it will be at the end of the age. The angels will come out and separate the evil from the righteous and throw them into the fiery furnace. In that place, there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. Have you understood all these things? They said to him, yes. And he said to them, therefore, every scribe who has been trained for the kingdom of heaven is like a master of a house who brings out of his treasure what is new and what is old. And Lord, we do pray now that you would, by the power of your Spirit, through your word, open our eyes to see. Lord, that which we need to see and that which we cannot see apart from you. So Lord, be merciful, be gracious, we ask in your mighty name, amen. Well, if you will remember, chapter 13 is populated entirely with parables. And if you remember, parables are highly allegorical, highly symbolic stories that are designed to engage the imagination, paint a picture in order to make a particular point. And in chapter 13, every parable is intended to make a point about the nature of the kingdom of heaven, or what the kingdom of heaven is like, Jesus says repeatedly. Right? That it has certain qualities about it. There are certain realities that characterize the kingdom of heaven. And so hidden within the parables are truths and realities about the kingdom, right? They're veiled, they are cloaked, the meaning, the reality, the truths, the glories of the kingdom are cloaked and hidden within the metaphors and with the symbolism of the parable. And to the proud, right, for the arrogant, for the self-reliant, for the self-sufficient who reject Jesus and reject his word, those truths, those realities, they remain hidden. They don't see what they ought to see. They don't hear what they ought to hear. But to the humble who draw near to Jesus, who receive his word, who seek to understand what he's talking about, God gives grace. And their eyes are open to see the truths and the realities and the glories of the kingdom. And so this morning, Jesus gives us four more parables. The first two are meant to tell us that to be a part of and to possess the kingdom, that it will cost you everything that you have. But it's worth it, because you will gain more than you ever gave up. That it will cost you all that you have, but it's worth it, because you will gain more than you ever gave up. The third parable is meant to tell us that to reject Jesus in his kingdom, that it will still cost you everything you have. Only it won't be worth it, because in the end, you'll lose everything and gain nothing. And the fourth parable is prefaced with a question about whether or not we understand these things. And if we do, then it changes everything. So, First, let's consider these two parables in verses 44 through 46. Right, in verses 44 through 46, Jesus tells two parables about how the kingdom will cost true disciples everything, but it's worth it. Right, so parable one paints the picture of a man who's out in a field when quite suddenly and quite unexpectedly he discovers a treasure, right, hidden or buried out in a field. Now, at first, that picture might seem a bit random, even a bit fanciful, like, oh yeah, right, sure, somebody just finds a treasure hidden out in a field. However, in a time and in a society where there were no banks, there were no safety deposit boxes, people actually would really resort to burying their valuables out in a field to protect them. In a jar, in a box, they would hide them. So the scenario in the time and in the society that Jesus is speaking, the scenario that Jesus is envisioning here is actually quite plausible. It's not that far-fetched to the people of his day. However, is it not also true that the idea of hidden treasure is something that still fascinates us today? I mean, I think right now on TV, you can go on like the Discovery Channel and or Nat Geo or something like that, and there are multiple shows on TV right now solely dedicated to the pursuit of finding hidden treasure. Right, whether it's some sunken ship somewhere, it's some lost Mayan city where there's a vast fortune of hidden treasure just waiting to be discovered, right? So the imagery that Jesus employs here, it still resonates with us today, does it not? The discovery of some treasure hidden, buried, waiting for us to find. And Jesus says, the kingdom of heaven is like this. It's just like this. It is like the discovery of a hidden treasure. However, it is a treasure unlike any other. That it is a treasure of infinite worth. It is a treasure of incomparable value. And in order to emphasize that reality, Jesus then turns the parable and puts all of the focus on the cost, or on the price that this man is willing to pay in order to get the treasure. Right? Jesus turns the parable in a way, he tells the parable in a way that sort of stresses the point that this man, he can't just simply pick it up and walk away with it. I found a treasure, lucky me, let me take it and just sort of mosey on out of here, I'm rich. No, it's not gonna be quite that easy, it's not quite that simple. In order to get the treasure, in order for it to be his, he first has to cover it up. Why is that? Well, he needs to make sure he doesn't lose what he just found. I mean, somebody else might come stumbling through this field just like he did and find it before he can get it. I don't know if that's ever sort of happened to you. If you've ever been at the store, you really need something or there's something you really want. You go to the shelf, there's just one left, and all of a sudden you're about to check out and you're like, holy cow, I don't have my wallet, right? I've done this, and it's like, okay, I've got this thing. What am I gonna? And I take it to the far corner of the store, and I hide it behind like 10 other things. I'm like, nobody's gonna get this before I can run out to my car and get my wallet, or drive home and get my wallet and come home. So this is what he does. He hides it. He covers it up. I don't want anybody else getting what I just found. But now there's a larger matter at hand. He's got to buy the field in order to get the treasure. Right, and this is just basic property law that Jesus is dealing with here, right? That when you buy a piece of property, not only does the property become yours, but so does everything else within the boundary line of that property become yours. So in order to get the treasure, he has to have the field. There's just one problem. He can't afford the field, or at least not with what he's walking around with in his pockets. In fact, what it is going to take in order to buy the field is that he is going to have to sell all that he has, Jesus says. Right? In other words, it is going to cost him everything he's got in order to get the field and have the treasure. Now, here's the question. Can you imagine personally doing this? Selling everything you have. Can you imagine that? Because that's actually part of how a parable works. Jesus wants you to imagine actually doing this. He's not telling stories for your entertainment. He's saying, no, put yourself in this man's shoes. Can you imagine yourself doing this? So imagine Jesus coming up to you and saying, hey, how many cars you got out in that driveway? Sell them. How much clothes you got piled up in your closet? Sell it. How many dishes you got piled up in your cabinets? All right, sell them. How much furniture you got laying around this place? Sell it. Sell it all. Right? In fact, why don't you pack up the whole house while you're at it? Sell everything in it. Oh yeah, by the way, put the house on the market. Sell the house. Once you've sold everything you've got in the house, sell the house. Got any hobbies you really like? Requires gear and equipment and accessories. Oh yeah, sell that too. Anything else left laying around? Maybe some, I don't know, some stocks, some bonds, something you were saving for a rainy day. Yeah, sell that too. Sell it all, right? Liquidate everything, right? Take everything you've got, sell it all so that there's nothing left. Yeah, even the family photos. Your wife's gonna kill you, but sell them. Right, sell your family photos, sell all your prized possessions, right? Down to your very last pair of socks, sell it all. Liquidate everything, sell it all. Now, if you are able to imagine yourself doing this, okay, like just imagine if you walked out of here this afternoon and everything that you owned this morning, you no longer own any of those things this afternoon. Imagine. It's gone. Had it this morning, you don't have it this afternoon. Everything's gone, and you're left with nothing. Now, if you can imagine that, what kinds of thoughts, what kinds of emotions, what kind of feeling does that generate within you? Now, maybe it's so difficult to imagine that you have no idea what you would feel. I don't know. Weird? Uncomfortable? Uneasy? Totally out of place? This is such a foreign experience. I feel, I don't know, I feel anxious. I feel a little sick to my stomach. I got nothing left. Now, what would you feel? What would you be thinking? Now, take that and consider what Jesus says this man feels. Jesus says, in his joy, he goes and sells all that he has so that there's nothing left. As one biblical scholar notes, the specific word Jesus uses for joy is one that is used to describe those who rejoice, who are glad, that it is an experience of exceeding happiness and pure delight, right? In other words, for this man, not only does the thought or simply the imagination of giving up everything, but the very act of actually doing it was an experience of exceeding happiness and pure delight. Now, how in the world is that possible? How would that be possible? Well, it's possible only because what he knows and what he understands is that this thing that I just found in this field is so valuable that it possesses a worth that is so great that I am happy to let go of everything else in order to get it. So you can take it all. You can take the shirt off of my back, even. You can take the shoes off of my feet. You can take everything, because what I am gaining is far better and far more. See, the price that this man is willing to pay is directly tied to his understanding of the worth and the value of the treasure. That the treasure in the field is far better and worth far more than anything that he already has. In the words of one commentator, it is a supreme treasure of supreme value, and thus to possess it produces the greatest joy. Right? In other words, It may cost you everything you have, but it's worth it. Because you will gain more than you ever gave up to get it. And the point of the parable, first six words, Jesus says, the kingdom of heaven is like this. This is what the kingdom of heaven is like, that the kingdom will cost true disciples everything. How so? Or in what way? How is that true? Well, you got to remember that the kingdom of heaven is not something that is primarily physical, but spiritual. The kingdom of heaven was a phrase that Jesus could use that primarily had to do with the rule of God reigning in the hearts of men. And that's the cost. You can't have the kingdom without it. Full surrender to God's reign. You give up your life in full surrender to the king. He gets everything. He gets everything, nothing off limits, nothing held back. He gets it all. That's the cost. That's the price one must be willing to pay. But it's worth it. And this, brothers and sisters, is what spiritual eyes are able to see. This is what true faith recognizes and believes. Right? What transformed this man's sacrifice into joy was the recognition or the ability to see the supreme value of the treasure, that it was worth far more than any sacrifice he had to make in order to get it. Right? And so here is the grand irony or the grand paradox of the kingdom, if you will. The grand paradox of the kingdom is that when we give it all up, whatever it is that God may be calling you to give up in order to follow him, whatever it is we give up, we gain so much more. That's the paradox. It's unnatural. It doesn't seem right. I give up everything to gain more? Yes. That's how the kingdom works. Because if you believe that something is truly worth it, then you will invest what you have into it, right? This man did not just think that the kingdom was worth it or that the treasure was worth it. He knew that it was worth it, and he acted in a way accordingly. Right? True faith doesn't just believe something intellectually. It acts accordingly. And this man acted accordingly. He invested everything he had into getting it. And the point that Jesus is making is that when, through the eyes of faith, you really see the kingdom of heaven for what it really is, when your eyes start to sort of flicker open and the truth and the reality and the glory of the kingdom, you start to see it for what it really is, you will discover something that is worth your entire life, worth everything. Now, it's funny, this actually reminds me of a video that I saw recently, something I saw recently on YouTube, where a guy was kind of a social experiment where he was asking people, hey, how would you feel if I gave you $1 million? Of course, everybody's like, what do you mean, how do I feel? What, are you an idiot? That'd be awesome. Yeah, sure, $1 million would be great. Everybody he talked to, yeah, awesome, yeah, you want to give me $1 million? Sure. But then he sort of ups the ante a little bit. He says, okay, what if instead of $1 million, what if I gave you $10 million? How would you feel then? It's like, well, 10 times is amazing, I suppose. You know, that would be fantastic. That would be awesome. Yes, I would love $10 million. That was how everybody thought that was amazing. But then he sort of switches it up, and he said, what if I gave you $10 million right now? But you wouldn't wake up in the morning. Would you still take it? And everyone, almost intuitively, like reflexively, was like, well, no. No, I don't think so. I don't know. Right? Almost like reflexively, everyone chose their life over $10 million. $10 million right now, but you won't wake up in the morning. Can't give it away. You can't save it. You just, it's your, that's it. And everybody's like, no, everybody chose their life over $10 million, right? Everyone thinks $10 million sounds amazing. That sounds like a pretty priceless treasure. But everyone valued their life more than the money. Right? $10 million is amazing, but $10 million, nope, not in this case, not worth it if it cost me my life. Well, here's the twist. And here's the point of the parable. Jesus is offering us a treasure that is worth the cost of your life. In fact, it's the only thing that is ever worth the cost of your entire life. Jesus would later say, whoever loses his life for my sake will find it. That's the paradox. You lose your life, you give up everything for my sake, you'll find it. And therefore, let it go. Let it go. Whatever you're hanging on to, or whatever you're still clinging to, whatever you are refusing to give up that is keeping you from wholeheartedly following Jesus, let it go. Let it go. Because of all of the things that following Jesus might require you to give up is simply the means of getting everything out of the way so that he can give you what is infinitely better and greater. But again, nobody naturally thinks that and sees that. But those who are able to see that, it transforms our fear into joy. Right? All of our fearful hesitancies, all of our fearful sort of reluctance or unwillingness, or even sort of I don't want to surrender everything to Jesus, or I'm afraid to let this go and surrender everything to Jesus. All of that is transformed into a happy willingness to let it all go when you are able to see the value and the reward and the worth of the kingdom, that whatever it is you give up, you will gain more. More than you ever had to give up. That's the paradox. But it begs the question from all of us, is that the way you see it? Is that the way you see it? Is that the way we see it? Grant Osborne, in his commentary, he sort of offers this assessment, sort of this analysis, this final analysis of this parable. And he says, the message is that the kingdom is priceless and no sacrifice too great for attaining it. Therefore, anyone who resists the cost of discipleship has completely failed to grasp the greatness of the reward. Now, do you see how that challenges and tests our faith? That challenges and tests the mess out of what it is I really believe about the kingdom. Do I really believe that? You know, what we really believe about following Jesus, the worth, the value of following Jesus with my whole heart and with everything that I am, right? Ask yourself, is there anything that you're reluctant, anything that you are hesitant, anything that you are unwilling or even refusing to give up in order to follow Jesus more faithfully, right? Whether it's some sin, right? Or it's just some vain pursuit or whatever it is. Why am I unwilling to give that up? Why won't I let that go? Well, this parable would suggest that it is because you are failing to grasp just how much better the kingdom is. And whatever you're holding on to, and you're being duped and lied to and deceived, right? Whether by this world or by the deceitfulness of your own sinful heart, but you're being duped and you will never let go of it until you can see that Christ is worth the cost of letting go, that he's better. And until you do, you're stuck. That's the issue. But it allows us then to actually now consider the second parable, which is basically has the exact same point as the first one. Right? Once again, here's another person. They find this amazing treasure, this pearl of great value. And once again, its value is so great that it's worth, once again, giving up everything in order to get. The same basic meaning, except there's one key difference here. Right? Unlike the first person who sort of suddenly and unexpectedly sort of stumbled upon a treasure, this person's actively looking for something. They're searching for something. Now, is that not a picture of the human condition? Aren't we all looking for something worth living for, worth loving, worth giving ourselves to? Something that'll satisfy us, something that'll bring meaning and fulfillment into our lives, something that we think will make us happy. Aren't we all looking? And we search high and low for it. Spend all our days doing it. That was the book of Ecclesiastes. We search high and low, and all around, we live in a world telling us that what satisfies the heart and what brings the greatest joy into our lives is money and sex and clothes and cars and houses and entertainment and toys and possessions and titles and positions and careers and all that this world can offer us. And so often our sinful hearts become intoxicated with the spirit of this world, and we drink in its lies and its lusts and its greed and its values and its perspective, and we get drunk on it, all of which is trying to convince us that the very last thing on earth that could possibly satisfy you and bring lasting joy into your life is by having someone else rule your life, namely Christ and his kingdom. Because so often we are tempted to think that when Christ says, hey, it's going to cost you everything you have to be a part of my kingdom, so often we are tempted to think that means I lose. That means I miss out. That means I can't have what I really want to have. And I'm not going to be happy, as if Jesus just wants to take away all the stuff in your life that wants to make you happy and all the stuff that makes life worth living for. As if that's what Jesus is really doing. And yet that's exactly what we think. And Jesus, through this parable, is saying, hey, listen, if you believe that, if you think that, you've got it all backwards. He is the treasure of great worth, the supreme treasure who just wants to get all of the garbage out of the way. And even if it's not garbage, just these lesser things that we so often allow to distract us, the lesser things that we settle for in life, wants to get it all out of the way so that he can give us the far greater joy of the kingdom of heaven and that which truly satisfies us. Right? Jesus knows we're searching. He knows we're looking. That's why he said, come to me. Every person he interacted with, somebody was looking, somebody who was searching, and Jesus would say, come to me. Come to me, because when you come to me, when you come to him, when you leave everything behind that he's calling you to leave behind, when you enter the kingdom of heaven and you allow Jesus to actually rule your heart and you allow him to rule your life, you are gaining more than you ever gave up. And when you see the kingdom of heaven that way, right, it transforms the sacrifice into joy. Right? It takes discipleship. And it transforms it from something that might seem like duty to pure delight. Because in the end, I win. I gain more than I ever gave up. Which now brings us to the third parable. And it begs a question. Well, what happens if you don't see it that way? Right? In fact, to the point where you reject the kingdom of heaven. Right, you reject Christ, you would rather live for yourself and all that this world offers. You'd rather rule your own life, go your own way, build your own kingdom. You think that's better. What happens if you see it like that? Well, Jesus tells us another parable. That if that's the choice that you make, if that's the way that you see it, if that's the path that you choose, then in the end, it's still going to cost you everything. Only this time, it won't be worth it. Right, if we go back to that quote earlier about those who resist the cost of discipleship failing to grasp the greatness of the reward, let me just, I don't know if I could add an additional statement to that, that those who reject the cost of discipleship have also failed to grasp the terrible alternative. Right? It's not just that you miss out on the treasure. It's like, ah, darn, shoot, I guess I'm one of those who don't, I don't get the treasure. Oh, well, missed out. Other people can have it. No, you still pay the ultimate price. Only this time you will lose everything and gain nothing. That's the parable. Right? Jesus tells a parable to say that one should embrace the kingdom not only because of its supreme worth, but also because the alternative is terrible beyond belief. You just don't know it yet. You can't see that either. And so Jesus tells a parable, right? How the message of the kingdom of heaven, it goes out, right? Like a net being cast into the sea, right? To catch as many fish as possible. But when the fishermen bring the net back onto the shore, turns out some of the fish are bad, right? They're not edible. They can't be eaten. They can't be sold at the market. They have to be thrown away. And the point there is that there is a sorting that's coming. There's a separation that is coming. Jesus says, at the end of the age, verse 49, right? And so, yes, for now, Jesus continues to eat and drink with people of all kinds, sinners and tax collectors and Pharisees and the religious and the irreligious and every kind of person in this world that you can imagine. The message of Jesus is going out, and he is calling them in order to seek and to save the lost. But in the end, there will be a day of judgment, and there will be a great separation that occurs, and it will reveal those who truly believed his message and those who did not. Those who embraced his kingdom with faith and those who did not. Right? Those who surrendered their lives to his rule and to his reign and those who did not. Now, presently, right now, in this world, in this life, as we live, we all sort of live side by side together. We're all like fish swimming in the same sea together. And so often it does seem like what has value and what has worth and what will satisfy and what will make us happy is all that this world is living for, all that it's sort of swimming to. Even if that means sinning in order to have it, in order to experience. And so even sin can seem worth it. And Jesus tells us this parable in order to say, don't be a fool. It is not worth it. Don't be a fool. Again, you are being lied to and you are being duped. What does it profit a man if he gains the whole world and yet forfeits his soul? Jesus will say in Matthew 16, verse 26, do not love the world or the things of the world, for all that is in the world, the desires of the flesh, the lusts of the eyes, the pride in possessions is not from the Father, but of the world. And the world and all of its desires are passing away. But whoever does the will of God lives forever. This is 1 John 2, verse 15 through 17. Again, commentator Grant Osborne writes, in this world, and even in the church, the good and the bad live side by side, right? The believing and the unbelieving, we all live side by side. And we cannot finally separate them, but in the end, God will do so unerringly. And justice will prevail. This is the final answer to the age-old question of why the wicked flourish, right, seemingly, while the righteous so often have nothing. That scenario is only true in this world. But in the final kingdom, a final judgment and separation will occur, and those who are playing games with God, as well as those who flaunt their evil, will pay with eternal consequences. In other words, it'll still cost you everything, only it won't be worth it. Verse 50. It's not worth it. Which then brings us to the final parable in verses 51 through 52. Now, one of my favorite stories in the Old Testament, it's a bit of an obscure reference, but in my opinion, I think it's one of the most dramatic, is there's a story in 2 Kings chapter 6 where Elisha and his servant are surrounded by an enemy army. There's a sizable enemy army that's moving through the valley that has come to conquer and destroy the city that they are in, presumably kill them as well. And Elisha's servant is panic-stricken. He's freaking out. We're going to die here. And Elisha very calmly says, relax. Those who are with us are greater than those who are with them. And Elisha's servant looks out. He's like, what are you talking about, man? I'm like, there's nobody with us. Right? Look out the window. Nobody's coming. Nobody's here. There's nobody with us. And then Elisha prays and says, God, open his eyes that he may see. And suddenly, in that moment, his eyes are opened, his spiritual eyes. And the Spirit of God opens his eyes to see things that are spiritually discerned. And when he looks out again, what he sees, rushing down the mountains into the valley, descending upon the enemy, are horses and chariots of fire, as the armies of heaven have come to defend them. Couldn't see it before, and then he saw it. It's an awesome scene. See, these parables contain spiritual realities, right? 100% absolutely, totally true realities, but spiritually discerned realities. Realities that require the Spirit of God to open our eyes to see them, or we're not going to see them. Right? And like this servant, right, every true disciple now sees things that we did not see before, things that were always there, but things we couldn't see. And so Jesus tells a final parable about what it means for every disciple who is able to spiritually discern. He first prefaces the parable with a question about what his disciples see. Do they see? Have you understood all these things? He's at, what do you see? How do you see it? Have you understood all of these things? And they say, yes. And Jesus tells a parable, okay, here's what that means then. Every true disciple then is like a scribe who now represents the kingdom of heaven. Now see, the official job description of a scribe in Israel was to interpret and then teach the Torah, right? The law of God, the revelation of God in the scriptures. That was the job of the scribe. They interpreted what God said. They then taught what God said. They were teaching the reality of and the things of God. But the scribes of Israel, Jesus would later say that they were like blind guides. They couldn't see. Right? They couldn't rightly interpret and then teach the scriptures because the scriptures lead to Jesus and they had rejected Jesus, and so they're blind. They don't see the things of God that they ought to see. But the disciples who had embraced Jesus, they were now being trained by Jesus to interpret and to understand the things of God, in particular the mysteries of the kingdom, so that they could then proclaim the realities and the glories of that kingdom to the world around them. And Jesus describes that newfound job description of a scribe of the kingdom as being like the master of a house. Or like a storehouse, more fittingly. Right? It's a storehouse, Jesus says, that's full of treasure. Right? Jesus is keeping this treasure imagery going here. That as disciples who are now in charge of this storehouse, right, we are now stewards of a treasure. Right? It's a treasure that involves both what is new and what is old, Jesus says. Right? In other words, all of the old covenant promises of God in the Old Testament scriptures that are now being fulfilled in the new covenant work of Jesus. Jesus is now the link between the old and the new, right? So the entire revelation of God to man from Genesis to Revelation that is now being fulfilled in the person and work of Jesus Christ that grants us access into the eternal joy and glory of the kingdom of heaven, that is the treasure that we are now stewards of. And disciples whose eyes have been open, I see it. We now offer that treasure to the rest of the world, right? Proclaiming the worth and the value of Christ's kingdom over everything else in this world. And we do that not just by the things that we say, but by displaying the worth of Jesus and how we live. We live in such a way that says to this world, Jesus is worth more. Everything you're living for, Jesus is better. He is worth more. He is better. Though it may cost you everything you have to follow him, he is worth it. Though you may have to lay down your life in order to surrender to his rule and his reign, his rule and his reign are better. He is the supreme treasure of supreme value that produces the greatest joy. And brothers and sisters, you and I, we must pray every single day like Elisha prayed in order to see it. God, help me see it. Open my eyes. Because here's the truth. You and I are going to walk out of here today. And as soon as we do, the world will once again be calling for your allegiance. And calling for your attention and calling for your affection, for you to love what it loves. And there will be times where it will look better. That the real treasure, it's right through those doors and it's what the world is offering me. There's times where the real treasure is somehow, it's going to look like it's in the world and not in the kingdom. But appearances are deceiving. Right? Jesus says, this treasure, it's hidden. Yeah, appearances are deceiving because the treasure of the kingdom, it can't be seen by the world or by us with natural eyes. Only eyes of faith can see it. And so brothers and sisters, we need to pray, God, open my eyes to see it. And here's what I know, that Christ has given us his word so that through it, his spirit can open our eyes to see it and bring us to faith. So one more time, and the band can come. But under the authority of Christ's word, one more time, let me appeal to you. Whatever it is that you are afraid to give up, whatever it is that you have been reluctant to let go of, whatever it is that you're hanging on to that is keeping you, and it could be a thousand different things in a thousand different ways to every single one of us in different ways. But whatever it is that you're hanging on to that is keeping you from wholeheartedly following Christ, let it go. Let it go. Lay it down. Let him rule. Let him reign. Let him have your heart and let him have your life, because what he is offering you is worth more and it is better. One final quote. We'll end with this and then we'll sing. The kingdom of heaven is hidden in this world, known only to those who belong to it, yet it is the most precious, valuable reality this world has. In this sense, these parables sum up not just chapter 13, but the entire gospel thus far. Christ has brought with him the kingdom that the Old Testament was waiting for, but neither the world as a whole nor the Jewish people have recognized or accepted it. Yet it is the fulfilled promise of God and the sum of everything humankind has wanted. Brothers and sisters, that is what Christ is offering us. The sum of everything humankind has wanted. It's there in him. In light of this, there is only one possible reaction: the radical surrender of one's whole life in order to have it. It is the greatest prize this world will ever see, but one must throw off everything else. So Lord, help us. Help us to see. And Lord, May we throw it off and let it go, believing you are better. We ask in your name, amen. Let's stand, let's sing together.